Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 23rd, 1989, and fireside this afternoon is Ann Peterson's session called The Blues, an affirmation that life still swings, number 99-4. Let's listen in.
Peterson. And some of you, how many of you have not been to this session, these at all? Some of you have it. I teach religion, theology at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And we have a couple of Sioux Falls folks here along. My major area is systematic theology. And in the last few years, I've been doing a lot of work in religion and science, but also have decided to draw on my background that I have in music. I was trained as a classical musician in piano and flute and taught that periodically for about 10 years. And I'm stepping off into dangerous territory with the blues and jazz because I don't play it, and I've just begun to listen to it. But I want to explain just a little bit today, sort of autobiographically, why that might be that I'm growing more and more interested. Part of it is when we lived in Chicago for a number of years and I did my graduate work, we had a group of dog owners that would run their dogs out in the seminary courtyard. And one of the dog people we got used to running into all the time had three pit bulls and a Doberman, and the Doberman's name was Precious. And they would come, and he turned out to be one of the best area blues players. And we got to know he and his partner a little bit, and she worked at the seminary and would say, well, Dion's playing up at the Kingston Mines, you ought to come up and hear him. So we went as much as we could take it. I have an allergy to smoke, and going, if you've been to the Kingston Mines in Chicago up on the north side, at some points the room that they play in is not a whole lot bigger feeling than this, at least it feels that way, and it's wall-to-wall people. We would wait outside sometimes to get in, and Dion Payton and the 43rd Street Blues Band, and I fell absolutely head over heels in love with that band. And I don't know what it was. I think his style wasn't, I gather, a real classical blues. It was more of a...
urban Chicago blues, yeah, for sure.
They called them, you know, these newer blues groups, they called themselves the Chicago Blue Bloods, the newer Chicago blues. And I just fell in love, and we would go up there and listen, and usually would lose my hearing for about 24 hours because it was a small space with this unbelievable sound. But we spent the nights that we could, when we could afford it, to go up and listen to Dion Payton. And usually when we go back to Chicago, if we can squeeze a trip in, we head up to the Kingston Mines and listen. And then this spring, I bought my first double CD album of women's blues singers, and I just love that album. I think some of the songs, I played one the other day, I Don't Need a Man to Tell Me What to Do. I'm just joking here, but they're wonderful songs that express a whole different side again of the blues culture. And I think part of what I love about the blues is kind of a deep down feeling that the music is saying something that I really feel. And even though the blues comes out of a whole different culture than I come from, I think there are shared sympathies, and that's why the power of the blues is so important. So I began to just do a little research, do a little thinking about why that music might be so important. And also in my own background, my family background, my uncle was a great jazz lover and a great, I guess, one of the best dancers. My dad, same thing, loved jazz. So somewhere deep in my family roots, there's a tremendous love for jazz. And I'm just starting to kind of get in touch with that. And as I've been working on this new book manuscript, I've always been in touch with my uncle, but we have a new stage in our relationship. He's been writing these wonderful letters to me, 2-3 pages, reminiscing about his love for jazz and the blues. And so I've been keeping some of these letters, hoping that somehow they're going to get incorporated into the manuscript of the book, because they're wonderful reflections on someone who finds a deep spiritual connection to this music. There's also, and I'll try to think of his name before the end of the hour, if I can, a composer in Billings, Montana, whose liturgies are beginning to be quite popular, that he's actually composed, like, LBW words to the blues. And I know the campus minister, a friend of ours, John Christofferson, you might know him, Deanne, is getting 200 to 300 people on Sunday mornings at the campus ministry. They're bringing in professional musicians. Yeah, so it's really pretty amazing. These services are attracting lots and lots of people. Campus ministry there used to have maybe 10, 15 on Sunday morning, and they're drawing in hundreds of students. So that's just a little personal background about the blues. Couple authors that I've drawn a lot on that I would offer up as resources. One is a short story that my mom and also a friend of mine, Janet Blank-Libber, suggested I read by a man named James Baldwin, a very famous African-American writer and theorist. And it's a little piece called Sonny's Blues. And it's about two brothers who live in Harlem, and one's a high school teacher, and the other brother is returning home from prison for having sold and used heroin. And it's a story of the sort of fearful anticipation that this teacher has about his brother returning home and what's going to happen, and whether his brother will be able to survive in the community. And his brother had always wanted to play jazz. And it's sort of the spiritual recovery of Sonny's, about Sonny, because he connects back with a group and he plays the blues. And it's this wonderful, I think, message about the music that helps one rise above their circumstances. And culturally, I found out even more about it. I didn't know all this stuff until I did some research on this, that bebop, which is the music that Sonny played, is a cultural critique of black music itself, and also particularly of white swing, which was the dominant music during that time. So bebop is an attempt to be a critical movement against white swing, which is interesting. As we were dancing the other night, I kept thinking about the kinds of conversations that go back and forth culturally. I've also done some reading in author that's somebody introduced me to named Albert Murray, and I have a quote of his up here on the board. And he says, blues, he calls it the blues idiom. He tries to describe the blues as more than just a musical phenomenon, but it's something that you live. And he says, it's an attitude of affirmation in the face of difficulty, of improvisation in the face of challenge. It means that you acknowledge that life is a low-down, dirty shame, yet confront that with perseverance, with humor, and above all, with elegance. I used this as a sermon text, I remember, at St. Olaf a few years ago that Deanne was part of for Lent. And this has sort of become my Lenten theme. I've never been one in the church here. As soon as it hits Lent, I try to forget that the church here is around. I've never been, I don't know, I haven't had a metaphor. And I think part of it is, I know in Roberta Bondi's book, Memories of God, I don't like all that bloody sacrifice language that goes with Lent and the cross, and that the main metaphor that I hear about cross and resurrection is so sacrificial. And so I've always kind of dreaded Lent and Good Friday. And the blues language has helped me find a different sort of spin on what Jesus experienced and what the church's experience of Lent is about. And of course, the lament psalms are another part of the tradition. It's interesting that the Lutheran Book of Worship leaves most of them out, which may say something. I just find that really fascinating. Even the ones, I mean, some of the language is brutal about crushing people's heads on rocks and doing awful things, but it still gives voice to this angry, negative side of experience, and we've kind of left that out of the tradition. But the lament psalms are another, and there's lots of expressions that one could find in scripture of this kind of, I think, theology. I put it into that language, obviously Albert Murray isn't, but it's the notion that you talk about life as a low-down, dirty shame, and yet it's not being stuck there. It's rising above that and finding strategies to do that. Borrowing or listening to another culture's music is always I think, important for me to acknowledge. I don't come out of the African-American community, so I always worry a little bit about how one listens to and works with music that is not particularly your own tradition. And I think the metaphor that was most helpful for me, and I still have these lists, if anybody wants a bibliography, Robert McAfee Brown's little book, Listen, I think it's Theology in a New Key. It was written in the 70s for on liberation theology. And he talks about needing to listen and learn from other traditions or listening to other music. And it's not that it's your music, but that in listening to it, you begin to sense and experience a whole different culture. So I think that's been the metaphor that I've tried to use with the blues, is it gives me somebody else's experience, and I think then that's its universal appeal. I mean, the blues clearly has a universal appeal. As I did all the research for some of this on this chapter, there were just loads and loads of articles, particularly in Downbeat magazine, about African American culture worrying about the blues, so that when you go up to the Kingston Mines, there are no longer any black people in the crowd, it's all white people. Like, there's worry about why their culture isn't passing the blues on to the youth. And so there's an attempt to get conversation going between the younger rap artists and some of the new different kinds of African-American music that are rooted in the same traditions. So anyway, just a little bit about where the blues come from. Most of you probably already know this, but it was important for me to just talk about this. The resource I'm using most is James Cone's book on the spirituals and the blues. It's just a very small piece, probably 100 and some pages, that looks at the theological issues in spirituals and the blues. James Cone teaches at Union Seminary in New York. And most of the authors, including Cone, that I look to, trace, of course, the roots of the blues all the way back to Africa, but particularly then when it comes to the States, in the form of what he calls the slave seculars. That is, they're not religious music. He says they express the tensions and skepticism that slaves experienced about white folks' religion. Because particularly, the theme, of course, during that time is that white Christians find ways to legitimize slavery. And so I think to look at the roots of the blues as a secular critique of white Christianity, interestingly enough, the more and more I read about the blues, the more and more I found roots of feminist womanist theology. The same kinds of hints that what you do is you look for the strands of Christianity that are still present in our thinking and in our culture that are used to oppress people. And we can put that language into the other forms of slavery, whatever it is that the church still legitimizes as a way to oppress people. So the blues come out of that experience. They share the same ancestral history as the spirituals, but I think they express it differently. He talks about the blues being very this-worldly, and you listen to them. They're expressed about relationships like, I don't want to take any crap from the man, or I'm singing about my family, or about having problems. They're very focused on expressing frustrations in this world. Again, in an intentional contrast to the kind of otherworldliness that might be expressed in the spirituals. Although Cone is very clear that even that otherworldliness is not the same kind of individualistic Christian escapism that white Christians have so often used it as. Spiritual, and he talks about the blues in particular, is a sense for search for truth. It's a communal expression for searching for truth. It's interesting how much the blues are used and labeled later as devil's music, both by that culture and by the white culture. And in a book by Angela Davis that I read on black feminism and the blues, she talks about as women began to be more popular when they sang the blues, black women became very quickly labeled as the devil's tempters. It was interesting, kind of the bedevilment. And of course, here she talks, I'm just going to give this brief quote from Davis, "The blues women openly challenge the gender politics implicit in traditional cultural relationships of marriage and heterosexual love relationships. refusing in the blue traditions of raw realism to romanticize romantic relationships. They instead exposed the stereotypes and explored the contradictions of those relationships. And by doing so, they redefined women's place. They forged and memorialized images of tough, resilient, and independent women who weren't afraid of anything. She talks about them almost becoming like women priests for the black community, offering a different way of being in the world. And it's interesting that their music gets labeled music of the devil. Same sorts of rumblings that happen still, I think, in movements that become critical of dominant Christianity. It's just it's easy to label it. And yet, the word bedevilment has a little subversiveness. So you can turn that on its head, I think, and talk about the very notion of bedeviling something as pulling out the demonic in the tradition that you're criticizing. So if that makes any sense, I think part of the power of the blues, of course, is to be critical of the demonic within the white culture, the same way I think that feminist theology bedevils the Christian tradition in the sense that it tries to root out the demonic within Christianity. Blues are really a way, again, with this notion of the demonic, to give voice, to give expression. Any time that you take away someone's voice, you take away their power. I read and was just sort of reminded again when Clinton did his sort of poverty tour this last few weeks before we came up here. He was in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And people, a lot of us talked again and again about what happens when a whole culture loses its voice. You know, when they weren't allowed to use their religious ceremonies to speak their own languages, I don't know how many decades that went on. But you think of that same kind of losing a voice, and what the blues do is to give really expression to the community.
You said they weren't allowed to use their
own language.
And what, I'm not sure.
It was outlawed. I mean, they weren't allowed to speak. Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Just talking about the experience on the Indian reservation being similar in some ways to what happened to the black community.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. I didn't make that transition very well. Thanks.
3:30 and I missed a lot of
that's all right. And feel free to clarify those things. These notes are a little bit scattered. Finally, the thing that I want to talk just the last about, and then I'll let Gary start in here with is this. Particularly in Albert Murray's work, talks about the fact that the blues is a highly stylized art form. I think the danger is like with jazz, you think, well, I'm just going to get up and sing about what's wrong with me, and it's not really an art form, it's just kind of a do-your-own-thing. And Albert Murray talks about the fact that the blues itself is a very stylized art form that is passed on through community. Again, this notion that you learn and you're part of the blues by being around people in the musical world who sing and learn and express the blues. So it's really a highly ritualized experience, and one that he's very clear that you don't need this. I mean, he's trying to make this careful connection that blacks, that in order to sing the blues, you don't have to suffer. In other words, there isn't a direct correlation, so that we don't make people suffer so they can sing the blues. But this comes out of the experience. And just one more quote. He says, this is actually from James Cone. The blues are true because they combine art with life, poetry and experience, the symbolic and the real. They are an artistic response to the chaos of life. I kind of like that. The blues, in other words, give structure to the chaos that people experience in their life. And to sing the blues truthfully, it is necessary to experience the historical realities that created them. Now, that could be somewhat of a controversial topic, you know, whether, and I think that's even, that was an ongoing discussion in some of the literature I looked at, whether white people can sing the blues. It's kind of a controversial subject, but there was wide diversity among the African American theorists that I read, and most, I think, tried to say, yes, you can if you understand, you know, where it's coming from, and that you don't expect suffering out of the people that you're working with. It's a way of listening to and learning, I think, again. If one can use that metaphor of listening and knowing, I think it's important to know where that literature comes from. So we realize it's come out of a tradition that's been very critical of the white experience. Take a little bit of time. This is kind of a general, very brief introduction to sort of the history and the power of the blues, much more than I ever thought I would read about, but I became absolutely fascinated with the whole culture and metaphor about where the blues have come from. So I'm going to let Gary take over a little bit, and then we'll come back to a discussion and thinking together about blues as a metaphor for cross and resurrection. Any questions at this point? Comments? Okay.
Well, I haven't read nearly as much about the blues as Anne has, and it's hardly my primary medium, but I've done a little bit of playing of it, and Anne kind of challenged me to, you know, if we're going to talk about the blues, let's do a little blues here. Challenged me to come up with some blues for us to sing, to be a part of. And that was surprisingly hard up here at Holden because, you know, an artist needs inspiration, right? And I just haven't been feeling too blue up here. You know, I go for hikes, I go fishing, I eat great food, I'm surrounded by people who are supportive and friendly, and it's just a little tough to feel too blue here. But I think I came up with it this morning. Those who are on staff here might especially appreciate this one. So help me out with the finger snap here. All right. Woke up this morning, didn't know why I was feeling so blue. Then I realized I've got garbology to do. At the sight of the compost and paper and cans, I began to wail. And then they handed me that dirty diaper pail, sorting that garbage, sorting that garbage all day long. I've never really done it till you do it the Holden way. Join me on the chorus, sorting that garbage. Sorting that garbage, sorting it night and day. Same line again, sorting that garbage, sorting it night and day. Sorting that garbage, sorting it night and day. You've never really done it till you do it the Holden way. You've never really done it till you do it the Holden way. I need help with other verses here. You know, woke up this morning. So as you're listening, if your mind wanders off to some verses, sketch them down, and we'll see if we can add a couple more verses to this later on. All right. I think it's interesting and helpful if, when you're listening to the blues, to know just a little bit about the structure, if for no other reason than it's kind of satisfying. How many times and in how many styles you hear the traditional 12-bar blues. It's used in country western, it's used in rock and roll, it's used in jazz, it's used in blues. It's amazing how many times when you sit down and listen and know what you're listening for, that you will hear the 12-bar blues, which is the structure that I used on that little piece. Not every piece of blues is in 12-bar blues. Certainly when you get to the more more modern Chicago blues style and so forth, there will be a number of different chord progressions and styles in that. But this is really kind of the standard you think of about when I think about blues anyway. And you don't even have to know a whole lot about music to understand it, but it's a 12-measure verse. and start with the one chord, the main chord, and that goes on for four measures. And after four measures of that, we switch to another chord. For those of you who care, it happens to be the four chord for two measures. Back to the one chord for two measures. Finally, a change to a different chord, a five chord for one measure, a four chord for another measure, and a one chord. So really all you need to know is listen for where the changes happen and the fact that, hey, this is a pretty simple style of music. There's only three different chords used in it the whole time. I'll play through that once and you can just sort of follow along. Here's my beginning chord. And though I'm adding little embellishments to it, it's the same chord for four measures. One, two, three, four. And it changes. One, two measures at that. Back to the beginning chord. Two measures of that. A new chord. Back to that second chord and the beginning chord. Okay. And once you catch on hearing those chord progressions, like I said, it's amazing how many different times or how many songs you'll hear that. It might be fast, it might be rock and roll. Much jazzier, and they might even substitute, instead of the one chord away across, they might put, but really they're just, it's just the same, building off that same chord. It'll change to the four chord after a while. Variations on that same theme there. Now, the text, the words, in a classic blues line, you give your line, which is, God, I don't know, is this iambic pentameter? I'm not enough of a poet to know. But it is five beats. It's got to fit in there. For mine, it was... sorting that garbage, sorting it night and day. All right? Garbage, sorting it night and day. And there's always some space in here at the end of each phrase that the instrumentalists will put in all kinds of fill. That's where they go wild instrumentally. And then in classic blues, that line is repeated again. Even though the chord changes here, sorting that garbage, sorting it night and day. The third line rhymes with day, but it's usually got some kind of a kicker to it. And in good blues, it's always something funny. What's the... nobody loves me but my mother. Nobody seems to care. Nobody loves me but my mother, and she could be jiving too. That's not the exact line because it doesn't rhyme, but I remember hearing that line and saying, God, nobody loves my mother, and she might be jiving me too. In this case, sorting that garbage, I don't know that I had a great kicker line at the end there, but you've never really done it. That's what I put here. Never really done it till you do it the Holden way. Okay? Let's sing that again and watch the structure, see how that fits in, and I'll maybe even see if I can put a little bit of a fill in there here and there. All right? Sorting that garbage, sorting it night and day. Sorting it night and day.
really done it till you do it the olden way.
And so forth. But that's the kind of the classic structure to it. One line, that line repeated, and then a third line that rhymes and gives it a little twist sometimes. So structure to it, and like I said, I'd love some extra verses to the first part of it, if at all possible. Woke up this morning, so sketch down your ideas, and we'll maybe try it a little later.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So Gary, that was the chorus that's structured that way. The verses are also structured basically.
Often blues is just that chorus over and over again. That kind of structure. That's kind of a variation on to do the that stop time thing. I mean, I guess you hear it a fair amount, but not enough that I would consider it, you know, standard part of every blues song.
Okay.
Yeah. And that actually has a different kind of meter to it. That falls into groups of four, and I'm not sure why that is. Oh, do 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 two, three, four, da da da. Ba dee da dum, ba dee da. So it's not that sort of five pentameter business. So the structure to that is different, and I don't usually use that, but it seemed to work this morning. Other questions? Okay.
When you talk about sort of the way the blues is structured, it's a wonderful vehicle for expressing things because of the kind of simpleness to put the complexities of life into. I mean, I think that's one reason it works really well.
Yeah, I don't know of any other form of music, any other, that sticks that closely to, I mean, when you're playing blues with somebody else, you know what the next chord is going to be. When you're playing some other styles, jazz or whatever, you might anticipate and guess at where it might be going, but it isn't so steeped in tradition, mm-hmm. you know, that established chord progression that you just know where it's going. And I think because it's so structured, you know, it's simple and it's structured, it opens up a whole lot of freedom for improvisation. You can really improvise that's what I start with students, using that chord progression, that style for improvisation first, because once it's an easy form to internalize, and consequently then the improvisation becomes easier.
Gary, yeah.
You know, normally I think of blues as telling some type of life story. Mm-hmm. Usually it's an example of life, but some of it, there was a PBS special on this last year, and some of it that they were showing was not just down and out.
Right.
There was some praise involved in
right.
it, and some happy endings involved
exactly.
in it. But, you know, some positive twists, so it wasn't just all negative.
Right. And even the negative is done to bring you out of the negative.
Right.
Right.
Bring it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The structure that Gary talked about, so that last line's a little bit of a kicker, and some of the women's blues songs I've been living through, yeah, you might lament a little bit, but there's always a twist that kind of brings in, like you're saying, a sense of humor or a way out of it, and I think that's over and over again, that just was emphasized over and over in the literature, is that the blues aren't meant to sink you down. They're meant as a strategy for getting you out of the situation that you're into, for rising above it, for critiquing it. And that's, you know, I think back to, again, the lament psalms might be the easiest thing for me, but I remember way back, I'm trying to draw on about 15 years ago now in my seminary training, but the lament psalms are also structured that way. They may have verse after verse of whining to God, but there's always a kicker at the end. Welcome back. How was the hike? Good. There's always a kicker at the end that affirms somehow that even though you feel just down and out or that God's abandoned you, somehow God will make something out of this. So the lament psalms have that same kind of structure that, and I think that's what Albert Murray's saying. It's really an attitude of affirmation. That's exactly what you're expressing in the light of difficulty. It's not simply to sink you down further.
But it's an affirmation, as you're saying, it's an affirmation that begins with realism. Mm-hmm. So it's not that kind of happy sort of bubblegum
right.
kind of music that was popular in our youth. Mm-hmm. Things just,
yeah, right.
It's very cheery.
Right.
It's really a much more profound kind mm-hmm. of affirmation, I think, that takes the world as a whole. And I'm thinking liturgically, the place where most often I've heard this used is with the Agnus Dei.
Oh, sure.
You know, remember in the old Chicago folk service?
Yeah, that's right. We haven't done that.
That Agnus Dei, Lamb of God who take away the sins of the world, mm-hmm. has that kind of bluesy tone. I don't know if it follows the structure, but it has that sound like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right. I don't remember.
And I think Haugen's Mass for Creation, the one that's used in the Catholic settings, has that same sort of feeling to it. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right, that is a place liturgically.
As with Lent, obviously.
Right.
But.
I remember Annie Dillard, some of you, her work is sitting over in the bookstore if you like that kind of thing. She's a poet and a prose writer. And in one of her books, I can't remember which one, it might be Holy the Firm, she's talking about going to her congregation all the time, and they go through the liturgy and they say the same prayers, and the pastor keeps saying the same prayers. We pray today for rain, or we pray for you to heal so and so. And finally, she said, one Sunday morning, he just stopped abruptly in the prayers and said, and we keep praying for the same things week after week, and they never happen. And then kind of went back to, I mean, saying, it was sort of an acknowledgement that sometimes things work out and sometimes they don't, and it's okay to stop in the middle of the service and express our frustration that maybe things don't seem to be going well. I teach with a colleague at Augustana who figures that this is so absent in most of our attitudes about worship. Murray Haar, who teaches Bible, was most of his not immediate family, but a lot of his aunts, uncles, cousins, relatives were exterminated in the Nazi death camps. And Murray lives with this sort of past about the Holocaust, and he's just horrified at Christian worship, at the way we take so little time to give any expression to anger or to frustration or to pain. And that's one of my biggest concerns in the liturgy, and we're going to talk about this more, but where you find places liturgically, and maybe we need to set a church as one foundation to the blues, or we need to find room in the prayers to give expression. We need to find ways, you know.
Just remember to have the confession of sins every week.
Yeah, right.
Would help.
Yep.
One of my pet peeves.
Right, and the Kyrie is another place, the
right.
Lord have mercy. I remember one year at our Bible camp in Montana, we did the liturgical year, the liturgy as the camp theme, so we'd sing or talk the Kyrie when we'd be climbing up a ridge, you know, and we'd talk about where these things fit into our daily life, and I know the students, kids, by the end of the week said, boy, when they went back to their congregations, all of a sudden the Kyrie meant something because they remember sweating and carrying 50-pound packs up, you know, it could be copper basin or something, saying, Lord have mercy, and really feeling it together. And even though that's hardly the same suffering as, you know, deep poverty or something, it does give you a little sense of how those words might come out of a deeper experience.
We had an interesting experience a couple of years ago. I invited John Ilvesacker to come lead worship, and mm-hmm. he did Born and Cry during communion, mm-hmm. and which really is kind of a modified 16-bar blues if you think
okay.
about it. But I've always heard that done in such a sort of a sweet style.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really irritated when he began because it sounded like grunge music. But by the middle of it, I found myself incredibly moved and realized that he was reading a lot more into the you know, those verses that walk us through life than most of us would, where we kind of think of that song as hitting the high points of life, but he was singing it in a much more dramatic, much different way. So there are ways to kind of reinterpret.
Yeah. That hymn we used, I have such a vivid memory of that. When my father died, I mean, he went to church every Sunday, but I think part of his piety was the children's choir. So he died early in June, and Bozeman schools were still in session, so we had this wonderful children's choir sing that during his funeral. And I always think of what a nice sort of commemoration that was. And they did it in such a way that they acknowledged, I think, the transitions in life. It's like there are ways to bring that into the sanctuary to give sort of expression, because we're not very good at it, and I'm included. I mean, you want Sunday mornings to be a place of refreshment, of time to gain strength, but I think we have carried some of that into what I have a British friend, Arthur Peacock, who calls it the happy clappy syndrome, and they have it in England. I mean, he's referring to that in England, but I think we're really good at it in our own settings, where the music, and you hear the word, well, we want to bring people so we can entertain them, and so they want to be there, and they have fun, and yet somehow that flies, I think, in the face of it.
I think people want to eat cake and cookies too, but if you give them that all the time, mm-hmm. it does not satisfy.
Yeah.
And I've often felt for a long time that the friends that I can laugh the most in the most joy-filled manner are the ones that know my pain. Mm-hmm. I know there's, and we can cry and weep with each other.
Yeah.
Then the laughter means something.
Mm-hmm.
I think the same thing is true in church.
Yeah. Yeah, where the church becomes that kind of community where you really know that you're safe to be who you are.
Both sides.
Right, exactly. Then the joy is much greater. And I think in theology, the doctrine of the atonement, you can sort of spread the study of who Christ is into kind of two categories. One we call Christology. Well, the whole branch is Christology, but you can kind of talk about the person of Christ. And the main issues in that are to talk about Jesus' humanity and Jesus' divinity, or how Jesus was part of the Trinity. But the sort of other piece of that is to talk about the doctrine of the atonement. That is, what happens, what is accomplished in God's working in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The atonement mostly gets talked about in terms of cross or crucifixion. When I ask students what it means to be a Christian, and I do this often at the beginning of my freshman religion class, I say, well, for those of you who belong or are Christian, what does it mean? And the most common answer is that Jesus died for my sins in order that I might go to heaven. Now, it's just kind of standard, or Jesus is my Lord and Savior and I'm going to be saved. Which in and of itself, we begin to talk about what that might mean. It usually has something to do with cross, meaning salvation. And then if you talk about that, it has something to do with Jesus' sacrifice. And very often, Jesus somehow paying a debt or satisfying the wrath of the angry God. I don't know that so many students have that trouble anymore, but I still think that's part of our piety. One of my friend's favorite stories, Phil Ball, grew up in a Norwegian Lutheran family. He remembers his 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid, the first time he went out, smoked a cigarette behind his house with a couple of his cousins. And he said he came back into his room and he had this big picture of Jesus on his wall. And he said for a couple of days he was absolutely convinced those eyes would follow him wherever he would go. So he said he finally took it and turned it around. Okay? Because what's our problem? Well, we're guilty, sinful creatures that need somehow atoning for, and Jesus has paid a debt or sacrificed himself, and the blood of the Lamb has paid all that kind of language. And that's the main metaphor. And that's, I think we need to take what Barb Rosin said about the you plural, and I think Lutherans need to recover the me plural. I mean, we talk about pro me, Jesus, the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ for you. Well, it is for me, but it's also for everybody else. But because the way Christianity has become internalized so much in American culture, it becomes highly spiritualized and highly individualized. I'm saved from my sin so that I can go to heaven, which is this place somewhere out there. And very often students too talk about being saved from hell, you know, whatever that might be. Martin Luther said that hell was a place dreamt up by fat preachers. I always thought that was kind of interesting, that the way to make money is to scare people into believing. You know, you get bigger offerings in the plate, right, if you're really going to scare people to death. So this notion of a highly individualized, highly spiritualized world that concentrates on the individual, if that's the focus of the doctrine of the atonement, what happens, I think, is that you lose this world, how people are oppressed, hurt, and how salvation, wholeness, or healing, we know that the word for salvation is not just about getting to heaven, but salvation is the word also used when Jesus heals people, the word for wholeness, how we can sort of broaden that up. So that what happens when we talk about cross and resurrection isn't only this language. Because this is some of the language, especially when it becomes highly spiritualized, that leads to, I think, a focus so that we don't have to concentrate on the kinds of systemic and individualized oppression that happen in our daily experience. And this is the kind of theology that the blues is so critical of. Okay, so this very otherworldly, escaped, highly individualized, highly spiritualized way of talking about what Jesus does for us that gets us away from looking at what's happening in our own life. And James Cone emphasized over and over that it was this message given by the white preachers to try to keep slaves in their place. Now, we'll just do your work and suffer. And it's also, if you connect Jesus' suffering as a virtue, as a way to get to heaven, you know, the more you suffer, the more virtuous you are. That's part of, I think, our Christian vocabulary and piety in some traditions. Even as recent as a couple years ago, I still have women students who come and say, my pastor told me to stay in the marriage because I'm not, you know, the suffering is part of my burden. And I need, I mean, you still hear that. After all the education we've had about battered women and about victims and stuff, you still hear this sort of strange legitimizing of suffering as a way of becoming a good Christian or as a way of staying in the pain and empathizing with Jesus. And that's very different than talking about the suffering that happens out of experience that you try to overcome it. I still think we often see this as a means of something that God gives to people in order to learn a lesson or to endure a test. Or one of the most memorable sermons I think I heard was when I was on sabbatical up at St. John's. I went to church over at St. Benedict's, and the priest that week spoke on one of the healing stories. He talked about the fact that a lot of Christians will say, well, I must have this illness, or God gave me this illness so that I can learn something from it, or God took my two-year-old so that, you know, I'll learn a great lesson or whatever. And he said, if that was the case, why would Jesus run around healing people? I mean, it would seem like you'd have a split somehow in the divine intention. That what happens in these wonderful healing stories is that God's will for people is life and wholeness and health and healing, not zapping people or putting people in places of suffering. So what I'm trying to do with this is to just lay out a quick, way too quick, but sort of broad sketch of the theology that I think needs at least broadened or expanded, or in my place, sometimes thrown out completely in order to start looking at a different way of talking about cross and resurrection. I want to read just a couple of very small quotes to you from people that talk about the blues. The old notion that the blues are depressing or simplistic is a gross oversimplification. The blues celebrate the human condition in all its flawed beauty. They neither judge nor pontificate. Rather, they embrace contradiction, even at its most tormenting, as the essence and spice of life. I think that, to me, is what Cross and Resurrection is about, is that my life and all of its contradiction, even at its most tormenting moments, is somehow not judged or pontificated at, but celebrated. That God loves me in spite of and including all of the flaw and tragedy that I could sing about in those blues verses.